Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome. Nice to see you all. Hope everyone is well. And since last time I saw you, today is January 31st, and we are joining together for our TGK Wednesday Night Learning. And tonight is the third session of the three-part series of on Judaism and Moral Society. And we are going to be studying today poverty, hunger, and homelessness. We are going to be looking at a number of Jewish sources touching on each of these elements of moral society, and hopefully have a chance to discuss them and learn from them. So I think we should jump right into it. We're going to start with a discussion of poverty. And we're going to see, we'll start off looking at what is maybe a familiar source from Maimonides on the question of hunger, which raises, however, an interesting question. So this is from the Rambam's Guide of laws of hunger, laws of gifts to the poor, Matanot Aniyim, and he says as follows. He's trying to understand, right, how much tzedakah, how much Matanot Aniyim, how much gifts to the poor we should actually be giving the poor. And what we'll see here is he sort of sets an interesting standard as to how to answer that question. So he starts off by saying, "L'fimashechaser ha'ani, ata mitzuveh liten lo." We are commanded to give a poor person according to what they lack. Im ein lo ksot, if they don't have clothes. We dress them. Im ein lo klei bayit, konim lo. They don't have household utensils. We buy them household utensils. Im ein lo isha, masiyin oto. So this may be the first one that sort of raises interest, right? Out of the ordinary. If it's a male and they're not married, we help them find a wife. Im haita isha, masiyin ota liish. And if it's a woman, we find a husband for her. Okay, so let's stop there for a second. If the ani is missing clothing, we clothe them. I think that's understandable. If someone thinks otherwise, they should raise their hand. I can't see everyone's screen, by the way. So if you want to say something, just unmute yourself and go for it. Seems logical, reasonable, that if a person does not have clothing, that the one of the requirements of tzedakah is to give them clothing. And similarly, if they don't have household utensils, things to eat on, table, chair, the basics, we give it to them as well. But then the Rambam says something which maybe catches us off guard, right? That we help the person get married, right? What does that have to do with matanot la'aniyim, right? What does that have to do with supporting the poor? Anyone want to try to explain that?
I'll take a stab at it.
Thank you, Rabbi.
If marriage is companionship, and companionship is what it means to be happy, a fulfilled life of means is achieved through finding one's partner in life. And sometimes people need to have help in finding that partner.
Okay, so it's an element of happiness.
Happiness and I would say spiritual slash social wealth.
Right. So it's good. Okay, great. Let me before we I comment, anyone else want to sort of take a stab at explaining why the Rambam includes helping someone find a spouse as one of the obligations of providing for the poor.
I think
Isn't
the Hasnasat Kala, like in the Gemara,
Sorry, say that again, Chana.
the Hasnasat Kala is in like the Mishnah or Gemara, right? It's like one of the mitzvot
And is
that
and
without the measure or something.
correct, but in that context, it's referenced as gemilut chasadim, right? Acts of loving kindness, not as something you have to give as charity. It's not characterized as charity. It's characterized as gemilut chasadim, which I understand that makes more sense to me.
How about companionship? Then he's not so lonely and feels degraded. Or how
Right.
about the obligation to procreate?
It's so one of the time, it's true, the loneliness is terrible, and that's why another Mishnah includes helping a bro helping well that they're actually in that Mishnah, it's not helping them find a mate, it's helping the married couple or celebrating the wedding. And that's considered gemilut chasadim, an act of kindness, but not tzedakah. Okay. Evelyn, what were you going to suggest?
The obligation for a man to procreate.
Right, so that's true, and so but how does so again so how does that fit into my obligation of tzedakah? Then it should include any mitzvah, right? Then the Rambam should have said, if they are unable to, if they don't have a lulav, buy them a lulav. If they can't afford a sukkah, buy them a sukkah. Right? If it's about helping them perform a mitzvah, why does the Rambam choose specifically marriage? So I think that one way to look at this is if we look towards the bottom of this text of the Rambam, he tries to explain his source. And then we're going to come back to the middle of the Rambam. The source is the pasuk in Devarim that says, "Dai machsoro asher yechsar lo." That tzedakah is defined, characterized as giving to the person enough to fill their lack, sort of their lack of their basic needs. And so, along the lines of what some of you said, it seems that tzedakah is not only about money. And tzedakah is about helping a person fill a lack of basic human needs. And one basic human need is companionship. And so that's why the Rambam includes it. Now, it may be an element of economics in the sense that if you have two people and maybe they could both be earners, and so maybe that helps, but I don't think really that it doesn't seem to me that's what the Rambam is getting at. It seems that the Rambam is getting more to this notion that we have to try to fulfill their basic needs.
So can I ask you a question?
Sure. Yeah. Hey,
So hi, I'm also looking at what this list of three things doesn't include, which it doesn't include things like food and shelter, which I would think is more basic necessities than the three things listed. And I guess I'm wondering if maybe I'm trying to figure out what those three things have in common, not just I'm thinking of it as all three of those seem out of place as opposed to just the last one.
Well,
Not out
the
of
Rambam
place,
addresses.
but
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
yeah, not out of place, but still like not one, two, and three on my list. Like I think food and shelter are one and two, and then everything else would follow after that. So could it be something like things that I guess somebody could get by without, but are still kind of make a life more incomplete? I'm trying to fit those three things together.
Yeah, that's a great point. It could be, it also could be the Rambam deals with food elsewhere.
Oh, okay.
When he talks about if someone comes to your door and asks for food, like you don't do a background check. You give it to them right away. But if they say, I don't have a place to live, then you do give them a background check. They're not going to die right away, but they may like die of starvation. I think that's the upshot. And of course, someone also may suggest that this is not an all-inclusive list. It's an example, and of course food is on the example, but like maybe this is less, like you're saying, maybe it's less obvious. The Rambam's next point is really curious. It's not his, it's from the Gemara, and says as follows. Vim hayta ish, afilu haya darko shel zeha ani, Lirkov al hasus ve'eved ratz lefanav. Even if this person was accustomed to riding on a horse and having a servant run before them, ve'ha'ani, and then they became poor, ve'arad min chasav, and they don't have, and they lost their wealth. Konin lo sus lirkov alav ve'eved larutz lefanav. Then the obligation of charity, of tzedakah here, indicates that you would have to then buy them a horse, and you would have to also get them a slave, to a servant, to run before them. Shene'emar, dei mechsero asher yechsar lo. The pasuk is very specific, to fulfill their lack. Umitzuve ata lahashlim chesrono, you have to fulfill their obligation, but you are not obligated to make them wealthy. Okay, so this is really curious, right? What is going on here? It's one thing to provide food and clothing and shelter, and we could even understand the requirement to provide a partner. Right, but if the person used to drive a Porsche and they lost their money and they had to sell their Porsche, I have to then go and get them a Porsche.
So why?
They get back. That's what the Rambam says. If they used to have a horse and they used to have an Eved running before them, right? That's what the Rambam says. That's the question. Why? Why is that an element of matanot le'aniyim?
Do you have to support this person forever? If he stays poor, so you have to give him. You're really working for another person.
So what's interesting here, and we're not going to get fully into it, is this talking to an individual, or is this talking to a community? Right. So that's a good question. Whether or not this obligation falls on one specific individual, probably not, probably falls on the community. So it's not one person's individual responsibility to do this. But what do you folks make of this curious requirement to bring them back to their previous level of wealth? And it raises all sorts of questions, right? Because if I'm doing that for one person, I'm going to have less money for other poor people.
So I don't know if this is relevant, but there's a value or a teaching that it's harder for someone who's fallen into poverty, who was used to a certain standard of living, than it is for someone who was born poor. So there's a different obligation.
Okay, so I think that Evelyn is hitting on something, which is the correct understanding of Rambam, although it does not fully explain practically how we do this. And I would also say that practically we don't, right? having been involved in various situations where a person where people need help, need money, it's not generally the case that charitable institutions, Jewish charitable institutions, even ones that try to do their work in accordance with halachic guidelines, will be able to do this. But I think what Evelyn is saying is that there's not one, and this is a little bit of a critique, although I don't have a better solution necessarily, but a little bit of a critique of sort of how we could in contemporary times think of a poverty line. If you have less than this amount of money, you're poor. If you have more than this amount of money, you're not poor. And what the Rambam here is saying, based on the Gemara, is that that's not necessarily what Judaism thinks. It's not suggesting that if you have that two people that if you have that if you were always poor, that you're not hungry if you don't have enough to eat, right? But what it's suggesting is that different people have different standards of living, and living below that standard in their eyes is a definition of poverty. Now, there are Gemarot that in the Gemara where it talks about this, it then has a whole bunch of stories which sort of scold people for getting accustomed to the high life to begin with. Like, we have to now support you to such a level because you accustomed yourself to living on such a level of wealth that now you are harming the rest of the community. But nevertheless, this is the standard that the Rambam notes. And I will share a really interesting interpretation that I saw. If you look here in the notes embedded within the Rambam, it's after it says that you have to try to get the person back to their original level of wealth, the Gemara records that a person from a dignified family became impoverished, and this great sage Hillel would hire a servant to run before him and announce his coming. Once Hillel could not find such a servant and perform this service himself. So I recently saw someone suggest that this story is meant to undermine the teaching, right? That if Hillel, the great sage, right, is going to sort of demean himself to run before this previously poor person, it's sort of a way of telling that poor person, maybe you shouldn't require this level of attention if the only way to get it is for Hillel himself to demean himself to run before you. And so it could be, it's not the only time that the Gemara does this. The Gemara sometimes has a halacha, which seems a little bit odd, and then has a story to undermine it. One of the most well-known examples could be the Gemara that says you're supposed to get very drunk on Purim, and follows it up with a story about two rabbis who got drunk and one killed the other in a drunken stupor. So it seems that that story is supposed to undermine the notion of getting drunk on Purim to begin with. So it could be that that's what's happening here. But in any case, what's certainly being expressed here is that poverty is not a one-size-fits-all notion, and that different people experience poverty at different levels. And outside of providing everyone the basic needs of food and shelter, like Yitzi said, there may be some things that have to be provided to some other people that may not be provided to a different individual or a different family because of the circumstances that they are accustomed to. I'll also note that when the Shulchan Aruch codifies this law, which the Shulchan Aruch does, it suggests that you only have to provide this sort of high-level support if the person's poverty is unknown. But if everyone knows that the person has lost their money, then all you have to provide for them are the basics. Now, it could be that that's another really important teaching, that the mitzvah of tzedakah is not only to provide food and shelter and clothing, but it's also meant to protect people's dignity. And so while people don't know that the person has fallen on hard times, helping them maintain their current lifestyle is a matter of protecting their dignity. But once it becomes known that they have fallen on hard times, then the requirement to maintain them at their previous level is no longer in play. I also thought that that was a meaningful way to explain the Rambam's ruling here of De Machtaro Asher Yachtamo. Okay, let's move ahead to another source that deals with poverty. This is a source that can be found in the Midrash, and it has to do with Eov. So the Mishnah, the Midrash says, "Eta ani imach," which is the quote from the pasuk that we were talking about, that you're supposed to support the poor person in your community. The Midrash says, "Ein ba'olam kashe min ha'aniyut, shehu kashe mikol yisurin ba'olam." Poverty is harsher than all suffering in the world. Amru Rabotenu, the rabbi said, Kol ha'yisurin litzad echad, if all types of suffering were on one side of a scale, va'aniyut litzad echad, and poverty on the other, to fill in the blanks, that poverty would be considered worse. Now, the rabbis make this statement, but don't say why. And so I'm curious to hear from you. Like, why do you think the rabbis would make this statement that poverty is worse than all types of other suffering?
I think that the thing about poverty is that, like, it's not worse on its own, but it makes every other thing you're dealing with harder. You can't get out of situations. There's no way out. You're trapped in whatever you're in because you don't have the resources to get out. So even though the poverty itself is hard, it's bad, but it's not that the privation itself, it's the way it keeps you trapped in every other bad part of your life.
Okay, that is a, speaking as my dear friend Chana Oshira, originally of Houston, Texas, now of Yerushalayim, Irak Kodesh. And that is a great explanation, Chana, poverty in and of itself is not the thing, but it just makes everything else worse because you can't sort of climb out of the rut. Okay, that was beautifully put. Anyone else want to share a thought as to why Chazal would suggest that poverty is worse than other types of suffering, than all other types of suffering? Any other takers?
I was thinking similar, like, to what Chana said. Poverty is the root cause of most suffering. Okay. So, you know, there's lots of things that are bad, but at the end, poverty is the root cause of why you're sick, why you don't have a home, why you, you know, have all these other levels of suffering.
Right. Okay. So, right. The other side of the coin from what mm-hmm. Chana, right, that it causes so many things, illness.
Poverty is visible. If you're sick, you can hide it. If you don't have anything, you know, you can't hide poverty.
Oh, okay. So great. So Mora is saying that it causes other types of suffering. So maybe what the rabbis meant when they said worse, they meant root cause. Chana said, what? Hold on one second. Chana said that maybe what the rabbis meant by worse is it makes everything worse because you can't help other stuff. And my mom says maybe it's worse because it's a dignity issue, right? You could put a smile on your face if you're not feeling well, if you're sick, you could sort of fake it to a point. That's true, yeah. But you can't, but poverty, it's hard to hide. And then it becomes an issue, like we said, maybe of pride or dignity. And as we already saw in the previous Rambam, that dignity is such an important element here that maybe that's why it's worse. Those are three really great explanations. Okay, Evelyn, go ahead, please.
Well, I do like all of those ideas a lot, especially what Chana said, is poverty makes everything worse. But poverty is not a death sentence or even a life sentence, and it can end and it can be ameliorated. And certainly there are types of mental illness that are much more difficult to endure than poverty.
So Evelyn is agreeing with the interpretations, but not necessarily agreeing with the original statement. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but mental, yeah. If you're mentally ill, you don't know you're mentally ill. If you're poor, you know you're poor.
Oh, people know they're mentally ill.
I have to
people know
say
when they're
I know that I'm mentally ill.
Yeah, no, okay. To that degree. It depends on the degree.
People know when they're mentally ill. Yeah, look, truth is, Evelyn, this is the type of statement where, you know, if we scoured the Midrash, we may find another rabbinic statement which would indicate something else, right? So this is not the type of thing which, right? So Evelyn is expressing a different experience than Chazal, and that's great, and that's fine. And it could be that, you know, also, although I do think Chazal had a sense of mental illness. I'm not sure if it was as honed in as ours is, and that's just a function of modernity and science and things like that. So well put. Okay. Here's an interesting text about the notion.
Can I just ask one question?
Yeah, sure.
If you're supposed to help them in everything with food and clothes and how long do you have to help them?
As long as they're poor.
Well, then there's no incentive to go out and get a job if somebody's going to give you the money.
I don't think so. Studies don't show that. Studies show that people would much rather work and would much rather have the dignity of being able to take care of their own needs than be receiving. It's true. What we see on the news, are those reports that, you know, people who are on the take, but that doesn't seem to be the truth. There's actually a wonderful book where I learned some of this from. It's called Give People Money, which is a book based on the idea that the best way to deal with so many of the social issues that we have is advocating for a basic income, and everyone in the country would be sure that they have a certain basic income from the government. And in that book, there are studies, and one of the debates that type of approach brings up is, well, people are not going to work if that happens, and that in countries where there are countries or not necessarily whole countries, but parts of countries or things where programs like this are in place, that does not seem to be what bears out. Most people want to be productive and be able to take care of themselves. Okay, so let's look at this next source about poverty, which is really, really interesting. The Gemara says as follows. This is the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat that says, Tanya Rabbi Elazar Kfar Omer, Lo lami bakesh adam rachamim al midazo. A person should always request divine mercy with regard to the condition of poverty. Shimhu lo ba, ba beno. For if he does not come to a state of poverty, his son will. This is depressing. Vim beno lo ba, ben beno ba. And if his son, child, does not become impoverished, the grandchild will become impoverished. And the Gemara's proof is this. Ki biglal hadavar hazeh. The whole pasuk, let's look at the whole pasuk. First of all, here's the whole pasuk down below. Naton titein lo v'lo yeira levavcha betitcha lo. Ki biglal hadavar hazeh yivarach Hashem elokecha v'chol ma'asecha v'chol mishlach. Yadecha. Give readily and have no regrets when you do, for in return your God will bless you in all your efforts and in all your undertakings. That's the full verse that the Gemara is using. But we'll see that the Gemara does something very clever with this word. Tana de Rabbi Yishmael, galgal hu shechozer ba'olam. See the word biglal? The word biglal has the same letters as the word galgal. Biglal means because, but a galgal galgal here refers to something that's spinning. Galgal hu shechozer ba'olam. The world works as a galgal. That's always spinning. Amar Rav Yosef, niktinan, haitzur b'mirabanan, lo ma'ane, v'haka chazin de ma'ane. A Tana from the school of Rabbi Yishmael taught, due to this thing, means that's a wheel that turns in the world. We saw Rav Yosef said, we hold that a Torah scholar will not become poor. The Gemara challenges and says, but we see that they do become poor. The Gemara says, even so, if there is a Torah scholar who becomes poor, he will still never have to go around asking for charity at people's doors. We're not going to talk about that right now, but we are going to look at this galgal. What's going on here? So I sort of tried to lay it out here. Biglal means because of, and galgal with the same letters is spinning. And so, you could read the verse differently, which is what the rabbis are doing. Give readily and have no regrets for when you do, for it is a spinning wheel. One day it strikes someone else, and another day it may strike you. May God bless you in all your work and in everything to which you put your hand. So whether or not we fully understand the biglal, galgal situation and what the rabbis did, what are the rabbis doing, right, when they say, If you're not poor, your kid's gonna be poor, or your grandkid's gonna be poor, it's gonna come around. Right? What are the rabbis trying to teach us here about poverty? And why is it important? And do you agree with it?
It's like the opposite of what I said, that it is a life sentence and it's a generational life sentence.
So you unpack that a little bit, Evelyn?
Well, I mean, we actually do see this in society as one of the greatest indicators if you're going to be poor is if you were born poor, unfortunately.
Right.
That if you can so I think what they're saying is if you can interrupt the cycle of poverty, then you are creating a benefit to the next generation and subsequent generations. So you don't just impact this particular person or this particular couple, but it has a much greater impact, which will eventually impact Klal Yisrael.
That's great. It could be that Chazal here are actually commenting on a different economic reality. Because if you think about the ancient, let's say, economic reality of being a farmer, so if you had a bad crop this year, you're going to be poor. But if you have a good crop next year, you're not going to be. And the same thing is going to happen with your children. There's going to be some years where they're going to have a good crop and they're going to be fine. And there are going to be some years where they have a bad crop, and they're not going to be fine. And the same thing with your grandchildren. Poverty in ancient times, and this may be counterintuitive, was much more of a spinning wheel than it is today. As Evelyn said, right, most contemporary research suggests that an individual's socioeconomic position is really very much a function of how they were born. And it's very hard to change that. This whole idea of just pull yourself up from your bootstraps, right, is not true. Now, it is true that there are countries where it's possible to emerge from poverty. But in a lot of situations, it's not true. So it could be that here Chazal are talking about a different economic reality. But what Evelyn is saying, that the takeaway, that's the point. That there may be one of the best from a perspective of a societal position of how to fight poverty is to is to change the generational nature of it. And once you change the generational nature of it, it likely will not return, as opposed to what Chazal were saying. So I think Evelyn's takeaway from that is excellent, even though, again, it may not necessarily hold true in contemporary times. And what's also interesting, though, what I like about this Gemara is it also reminds us that when a person falls into poverty, it's not their fault. No one wants to be poor. So by the rabbi putting it in the language of fate, by the way the wheel turns, or if we look at it as the class that one is born into, which is also fate, it's not anyone's fault or choice to be born into a certain class, right? So this also helps us sort of debunk the idea that people are poor because of their choices, right? And maybe that's exactly what the Gemara means here. Like Evelyn said, it's a galgal, and so some poor soul was born into a poor family. It's a galgal. They didn't choose it. So it also gives like a sense of sensitivity to poverty, that it's not always in people's hands. It doesn't mean that society can't try to have programs that break that, but it may not be easy on the individual to do so. The next
one, also,
yeah.
This is Mara. Sorry, I was also going to say that I also like how it talks about if it doesn't happen to you, it could happen to your son. If it doesn't happen to your son, it could happen to your grandson. This idea that hard times can happen to anyone. So even if you, I mean, and definitely in Chazal's time more so than ours, right? Society is much different now, but like many people who are living in poverty now, who are unhoused, they had good jobs. They went to college and they had good jobs and something happened. So this idea that it really can happen to anyone, I think I'm reading empathy in that, in these statements about this is something that could happen to anyone and it could be you and it could be your son. So, you know, be kind.
Right, exactly. That's the galgal. It's fate. It's, and the wheel turns, and sometimes there's just nothing you can do about it. Right.
I could add just a compliment to that. Part of the machinery of the mandate to aid the poor is to somehow identify with them. And while it's very noble for somebody to give just for the sake of giving, you know, the esoteric idea of giving becomes much more meaningful when someone understands what it means to be poor, and to what we've been talking about, how close each of us is at any given moment to becoming impoverished.
Right. That's a really, really great point. One of my teachers, Avi Weiss, is fond of saying, there's no such thing as the sick and the healthy. There's the sick and the not yet sick. So maybe there's the poor and the not yet poor. I hope that's not true. It's probably not as widely true as the sick and the not yet sick, but that's along the lines of what Barry Gerson is suggesting. Okay. I know it's a little bit of a morbid point, but true nonetheless. All right. Many of us are familiar with some of the policies in place in the Torah to deal with poverty. For example, in Vayikra, chapter 19, Ubikutrichem et Kitzir Atzichem lo tichale et patsa decha leksor veleket kitzircha lo tilaket v'charmecha lo tolel ufrat karmecha lo tilaket la'aniv v'lager tazov oto Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Certain parts of the field are not gleaned, and certain things when you glean in a vineyard and things fall, you have to leave them. Similarly, the Rambam here talks about some legislation, and as I mentioned before, to Yitzi and Ani She'ein Makirinoto. This is really interesting. We have probably all experienced this. Certainly, Rabbi Gersten and I have probably experienced this more. Someone comes to your house, or in our case, your shul, and they have a piece of paper signed by a rabbi that says this person is marrying off their 11th child, or this person hasn't worked, or they have a sick daughter, right? And they're asking for money. So, and you don't know the person. Now this person has a piece of paper that someone's vouching for them, but that's not necessarily helpful in that business. But Rambam said as follows: Ani she'ein makirinoto. Right? What do you do when someone you don't know comes over to you and says, "I need help"? Right? Most of the situations where we deal with poverty, we're dealing with organizations that we're supporting, under the assumption that that organization is doing the due diligence to make sure that the people who are getting the money really need the money, whether it's a Jewish Federation or some other organization. When we work with the St. Francis Center or TDK, right? TDK has done the due diligence to make sure that the things that we're doing for St. Francis are really going to the people who need them. So therefore, the rest of you don't have to do that. But someone comes up to you and says, "All right, I'm hungry. What are you supposed to do?" Ani shein makirino tova amar re'evani, echiluni. I'm hungry. Feed me. Ein votkin acharav, shema ramayu. We do not investigate whether the person is a deceiver. By the way, the most intense deception that I have ever been subject to was this gentleman when I was a rabbi in Montreal. He used to make the rounds in Montreal with a little boy who he said was his son, and they said, "We are both hungry." It became known that it was not his son. He rented this boy from a mother and split the take with her. Right? So talk about like high level deception. When someone comes and I'm hungry, in that case, we do not check to see if they are a deceiver. Instead, what do? We take care of them. We provide them with sustenance immediately. And you see the commentary there, because hunger involves risk to life. On the other hand, if they were naked, I don't think it literally means naked. I mean, they come and they say, "I don't have a place to live. I don't have enough clothing." V'yamar kasuni, and they say, "Help me with that." Botkin acharav shema ramayu. In that case, we do investigate to see if they are a deceiver. V'im hayu makirinoto mechasinoto lofi kavodo miyad ve'emokin. But if you know them and you know that they are legit, then you have to take care of them right away. So I like this idea, by the way. This is the Rambam's anti- the checks in the mail I gave at the office response. Right? If you know the person is legitimately needy, you have to help them right away. But if you don't know them, right, this is a little bit, I guess the equivalent of consumer protection. Right? You have the right to do a little bit of a background check to make sure that they are legit, right? They are who they say they are.
But I thought that Jewish law says the opposite, sort of what it says in the beginning here. We do not investigate whether he is a deceiver, that if somebody is begging, and it's a common conversation with friends about, you know, people on the street who are panhandling, we're obligated to not question their motives. Are they using it for drugs or alcohol, or are they really legit, or did they rent their babies? But they're asking, we're obligated to give. And if we can't give, we should at least greet them warmly.
So I would say that you're correct. We should not question their motives, but it doesn't mean we have to give right away. If a person says, I'm hungry, according to the Rambam, you should give and not say, well, if I give them this, right, I'll give them this, they're going to go buy drugs. But but not giving right away doesn't mean that their motives are wrong. You're wondering if they're needy at all, right? That's now, if you're convinced that the person under the underpass is needy, then by all means, and if there may be other reasons why you would give it, but I'm trying to thread the needle and suggest that if you don't give to someone, it doesn't mean that you're questioning their motives. It's you're exercising your right to give your tzedakah in the best way possible. And
prioritize people in the most need.
Right, exactly. You're prioritizing in a situation like that. So you're talking about, Evelyn, the specific question of a panhandler.
Because I thought there was a whole thing in the Shulchan Aruch, and I might have this wrong, about when somebody asks for money, you really are forbidden to question their motives. And that it goes along with this whole idea of the wealth that I have is a loan from God. And if I'm not going to use it appropriately, I guess he'll give it to someone else who will.
Okay. And, so, okay. I think here, though, I think what the Rambam is talking about is a situation where you're dealing with, let's say, an organization that gives charity. So since they're not dealing with their own money, they're obligated, right, to make sure that if you, Evelyn, gave them $18, that they are giving it to a legitimate cause. But you as an individual, when you encounter a panhandler, you may have other reasons to give them right away and say, you know what, it's my money, and if I'll take the risk if they're a charlatan. That's fine. But I, as a tzedakah organization, I'm not allowed to take that risk with your money. I have to make sure that your money is going to the right cause. And so I think that's how people look at this Rambam. This Rambam is not talking about an individual. This Rambam is talking about the soup kitchen or the whatever it is. And I got to make sure that I'm giving away other people's money responsibly. But you're right. You may have every good reason to give a panhandler a sandwich, $5, whatever you want to give them. And then you're saying, okay, it's my money. I could do whatever I want with it. And therefore, if they're not legit, that's fine. I don't care. I think that's the distinction, a good distinction to be made in a case like this, which I think we would want, right? We would want, when I give money to the Federation, we would want them to be doing due diligence to make sure my money's going where.
Exactly. I mean, there's so many people out there who are looking just to get drugs. How do you know where you can't just give anybody on the street money?
Right. So that's what Evelyn is saying, is we don't have to question people's motives. Maybe there are some people who are charlatans, but most are legitimately hungry. And some people have a different take. Some people take you to McDonald's, I'll buy you a sandwich, or they carry food in their car.
You know the story with Jonathan.
That makes you feel better about that. Go ahead, Chana.
I just want to say, I have friends who have been like houseless before and have talked about how, if you haven't experienced that kind of deprivation, like, you really can't understand, like, the rates of like dealing with assault and things like that just for being homeless is very high. Plus, most people are like disproportionately disabled or mentally ill, already dealing with problems. Drug use is a coping mechanism. It's a response to deep pain. And, like, to deny someone money, like, who are you to say that like the small comfort of like the warmth from this drug, whatever it is not an appropriate use when the money that you're giving them isn't enough to cover a hotel room anyway? You know, it's not going to fix the problem. And so like, you know, yeah. Just to the idea that somebody, because somebody is using drugs, they're not legitimate, doesn't really understand the human cost and suffering inherent to being homeless and like dealing with all of these things.
Right. That's a very compassionate response. I appreciate that, Chana. And yeah, it's true. Like, we know that a lot of homelessness is also a function of mental illness and drug and alcohol addiction as well. There's significant causes of hunger and homelessness. And so sometimes we judge people unfavorably for being in a situation like that. But again, since we're probably not dealing with tremendous amounts of money, right, a compassionate word or a smile or a small donation, while also donating to organizations that fight hunger and homelessness or provide services to people who are in those situations, is probably like a complete package, a way to go. And that's true. That's a great point. That goes back to what we said before. It's a galgal, right? You just never know what's going to bring you to the situation. Other sources in the Rambam talk about what the poverty line is. We're not going to get to that because I want at least, we're almost at an hour, and I want to at least touch on the homelessness issue. We've talked about poverty now and hunger. When it comes to the question, and some of the comments and suggestions here have been really very moving and show a real understanding and appreciation of these situations and helped us sort of draw out from these Jewish sources like a real compassionate way to look at these questions. So let's just spend a few minutes on the question of homelessness. So again, the Rambam deals with the question of homelessness when he says, "Maskir beit bayit l'chaviro," one who rents a house to someone else. Without specifying the termination of the contract, he may not force him to leave the home unless he notifies him 30 days in advance so that he can look for another place and will not be homeless. After 30 days, however, he may leave. He must leave. When does the above apply? In the summer. In the winter, by contrast, he may not force him to leave between Sukkot and Pesach. Let's look at one more source and then try to unpack them. Then the Shulchan Aruch says, "Kishem shamaskir chayav lahodiyo," just as the landlord must give notice, "kach hasocher chayav lahodiyo," the tenant must also give 30 days notice. Mikodem shloshim yom ba'ayarot o mikodem yud ben chodesh b'krachim. 30 days notice in the cities, 12 months notice in the villages, so the landlord can look for a new tenant and his house will not remain empty. If the tenant does not give notice, he may not leave unless he pays the rent. Okay, so let's talk about these sources. There are not a lot of Jewish sources that deal with the obligation to provide housing to those who rent. I think that would come. Well, let me ask you a question. If someone were to ask you, where in the Torah does it tell me that I have to fight homelessness? What would you say? Anyone? So I would say it would fall under maybe v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Right? The Rambam writes, love your neighbors as yourself is sort of a catch-all in a situation. It may fall under the pasuk that we looked at last week, v'asita hayashar v'hatov, do the good and right. Certain things that the Torah doesn't explicitly note, but we understand, would want people to do for us if we were in their situation. So that's how I would sort of source that requirement, although it would have been nice, I guess, had there been something more explicit along those lines. But what we do have in this case is the notion of relationships and obligations of landlords and tenants. Right, both of these sources indicate that landlords and tenants have rights and obligations. Right, so we see beautifully that tenants are protected against immediate eviction. Right, ensuring that they have time to find another place to live. If you really want to understand homelessness in this country, you should read a book called Evicted. It's a very powerful read about the terrible situation of low income housing in the country, and how so many people, you know, we said before that the worst of all is poverty. This book makes a case that the worst of all is being unhoused, because you can't fill out a job application unless you have an address. Right? You can't apply for Social Security unless you have an address. So many things you can't do unless you have an address. And that's just one of the small things I sort of learned from that book. So you're not allowed to evict someone. You have to give them time. And landlords are protected against immediately vacancies, ensuring that they have time to find tenants who could rent their property. So they have a reliable source of income. The difference is, it's hard to say who the Torah is favoring, the tenant or the landlord. But the tenant is always going to be given notice, and right, the Rambam goes to great lengths that you have during the winter, you can't evict someone at all. Now, this doesn't mean, by the way, that if the person's not paying rent, you can't try to claw back the rent that has not been paid through the Beit Din. But even so, you cannot throw them out. Right? You can't call the local constable or sheriff and throw the person out during the winter at all, which is a fascinating halacha. In today's sort of housing economy, there are, I guess, similarities and differences to what's laid out in the Talmud and the Mishnah. So in cases today, right, individual owners rent houses or apartments to individual tenants, in which case the concern for financial stability of the landlord still very much exists. On the other hand, unlike in the times of the Mishnah, today's housing market largely consists of individual tenants renting from large companies. And the tenants' vulnerability is much greater than that of the landlord, because if the landlord has an apartment that's open for a little while, it's a multi-million dollar company, it's not going to affect them as much as it's going to affect the tenant who is on the street. So there are some similarities and some differences between the situations. Someone want to say something?
A lot of companies actually keep apartments empty on purpose to raise prices.
Right. Right. They want to keep the availability low. Right. That's true. Okay, let's just look at one more source before we call it a night, because we're already over time. And this is a source also from the Rambam, but it's fascinating. Yitzi before tried to sort of categorize the obligations of tzedakah. So here's another opportunity for us to try to categorize why these things are in the same list. So the Rambam writes that if a person rents a house to a colleague, to another person, they are obligated to provide doors, to open any windows that have been damaged, to strengthen the roof, to support a beam that is broken, and to make a bolt and a lock, and to provide any other necessity that requires a craftsman's work. And that is a fundamental necessity when dwelling in a home and the courtyard. The renter is required to make a guardrail, which is, if you have a flat roof, to put a fence around the roof, so if you're up there, you don't fall off. Affix a mezuzah, prepare the place for the mezuzah from his own resources. Similarly, if he desires to build a ladder, fix a slanted roof or plaster the roof, he should do this from his own resources. So here we're seeing that, according to the Rambam, halacha distinguishes between certain things that the landlord is obligated to do and certain things that the tenant is obligated to do. So how would you, anyone want to try to sort of categorize the differences here between these, the list, to see, to understand what conceptually is the landlord's obligation and what conceptually is the tenant's obligation? So if there's no one, I'll make two suggestions. Anyone want to take a stab first? You see the list on the screen where it says Mishnah Torah hiring 6-3.
I guess the tenants ones are about sort of like small things about the requirements of like just sort of day-to-day life versus actual structural problems with the home that make it unsafe.
Ah, right, exactly. So it seems that when describing the repairs that require a skilled person, right, the Rambam specifically states examples that are related to safety and security. Broken windows, doors, and locks that could lead to burglary, and broken beams and a weak ceiling and things like that. So the Rambam seems to imply that the landlord's responsible for the safety of their tenants. You have to, you're going to make someone, if someone's going to pay rent, then that rent has to, then the place that you're renting has to be safe. The one exception is the guardrail, but that could be because the roof is not a necessary dwelling place. An alternative interpretation could be that the tenant is required to fulfill the biblical commandments of putting up a mezuzah and building the makkah and building the guardrail. It's like the tenant is given the opportunity, even if they don't own their own house, right, to fulfill those mitzvot, while the owner has to take care of all the non-spiritual stuff. So there are contemporary laws as well about rent and what's considered safe and what's not considered safe and what requirements the landlords have to provide, and versus what the tenant has to do, right? So in some cases, maybe the tenant has to replace the light bulb, but if the heating is broken, the landlord has to do it, sort of situation. But what we're seeing here is that there is a concern within halacha about the tenant providing basic things that offer safety and security to the the landlord to the tenant. I just want to show you one other source, which I use sort of as a teaser for the class, which is just so powerful. The Midrash in Vayikra Rava, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, he selek l'romi ra'asham amudim shel shayish nechusim b'tip te'ot basrav shelo yifak'u uvatsina shelo yikrishu. So when Yehoshua ben Levi went to Rome, he saw pillars of marble that were covered with blankets so they would not crack from the heat or freeze from the cold. Ra'asham ani echad, he also saw a poor person. Umachzelet kanim tachtav, umachzelet kanim al gabav. And all they had was a thin reed mat to sleep on and a thin reed mat to cover themselves with. I once heard in the name of Yitz Greenberg give the contemporary version of this midrash. And it was, how is it possible in New York City, every big city, that you look up and in an apartment there'll be a multi-million dollar painting by a famous artist, and on the street there's a human being living in a refrigerator box? Right? How is it possible this painting is sitting in a warm, well-protected apartment, and this human being is living on the street, which I think is the modern version of this Vayikra Rama. In any case, this was a quick sort of tour of sources that give us a sense of what Judaism teaches and what Chazal has to offer us in terms of poverty, hunger, and homelessness. There were some very beautiful and sensitive things said here that give us perspective and hopefully guidance on policy and what types of policies to support and what our personal obligations are and some of the underlying explanations and reasons for these conditions, as well as Rabbi Gerson and Hana said, an appreciation that just by luck of the draw, by the galgal, right, it could be us, which hopefully provides for us a certain humility and a certain recognition that that sort of a judgmental approach in these areas is not only not true from a perspective of how it happens, it's also very un-Jewish. And it's more appropriate to recognize the need for sensitivity. It's not take away the importance of responsibility and hard work and all those things, but that's not necessarily the answer. That's what we tell our children who are born into a situation where they can benefit from their hard work. That's not necessarily the right answer in a situation where no matter how hard one works, it's still going to be very hard for them. So thank you all for joining and participating and for sharing your thoughtful comments. I'm thinking of what the next series could be. I was thinking maybe the letters of Rabbi Soloveitchik. In recent years, there's been a lot of interesting letters that have been published that have not been published before. That's one topic I was thinking of. Another topic I was thinking of was sort of riffing off this book, which is in English called Marginal People in Biblical Times. It's a conversation of murderers and criminals and harlots and all sorts of interesting types of people.
Law and Order.
In the Bible. So maybe we'll, a whole chapter here on Zonot Ukadeshot, harlots and another name for harlots. So maybe we'll spend some time with some of the unsavory biblical characters. We'll see. Anyway, to be determined. Until then, oh, you like that one, Maura. Okay, good. All right. Have a wonderful evening, everyone. Nice to
Bye.
See you.
Bye. Good
see
night, Lila Tov, everyone.
Shakoach, Rabbi.
Bye.